I'm Nicolien Berger.
And I'm Jana Vosloo.
And this is Air It. Hello, Nicolien.
Hello, Jana. It's been a while.
It's been a while. It's nice to be on the mic again.
Yeah, so the last time I think that we recorded, we said that we're going to do it more organically, and then we disappeared for a couple of months. So now we're here to just, start again and catch you guys up on what's been happening in our lives and talk a little bit about my research. But Jana said she'll introduce what we're going to talk about today. So it's yours, Jana.
Yeah, so I think the last episode we recorded was with Stella Foyun.
Yes.
It was in December, like just before the holiday period, and we spoke about guilty pleasures. So since then, for Nicolien at least, especially, I think a lot has happened. She started doing her master's. She'll explain now exactly what the master's entails, but part of it was that she had to be in Cape Town on campus almost like four times a week sometimes, mostly like three times a week. And so Nicolien ended up often staying over at my place to make the driving a little bit easier. And we still had our air-ed conversations, but it was just off air because we were both tired and we just wanted to chat. And it always happens, you know, accidentally that we come to some kind of theme or topic and talk about that for an hour, but then we don't remember that we can actually record it. So
yeah, it often happens in Afrikaans.
And it happens in Afrikaans, also that. So I've been kind of hearing a lot of the development of Nicolien's master's project, because it's in live art and performance art, there's a practical component, but now she's also starting research for a thesis writing component. So we actually met yesterday at Nova Foundation for our weekly writing and catch-up sessions. And then I realized like there's already so many interesting things that maybe it would be cool to zoom in on her most recent performance and to talk about the role of play and the Volksmoeder and Afrikaner identity. So yeah, I just thought it was fascinating to me, and we have to absolutely share what she's busy with. So Nicolien,
maybe
you can fill in the gaps on what I didn't say now.
So what Jana says is correct. It's a practice-based research master's in theatre and performance at the CTDPS at UCT, so the Centre for Theatre, Dance and Performance Studies. And I didn't know much about what I was going to do before I started. I did that thing that I normally do, which is just to plunge into something. I had a thought I'd do a master's, and a month later I was enrolled and had to start, and also had quite a crash and burn start to the course, as I missed a lot of the correspondence that they sent from the point that I was registered, because there was something wrong with my email address, and basically got a phone call in the middle of February while I was sitting in bed writing, like, are you still coming to campus? And I'm like, coming for what? And they're like, no, you're supposed to meet your supervisor today. And I was like, oh shit, I'm in Fishhook, I need to get there. Jumped in the car, got there an hour late, missed meeting my supervisor, and basically just started. So that was quite overwhelming. And I had to work through a lot of blocks and limiting beliefs around masters. So that's just the emotional, spiritual side of studying again. And which I can get into, but I thought to start by basically telling you guys about the rationale for the study, as I wrote it yesterday at our writing thing at the Noel Foundation. And it kind of sketches a picture of where I started to where I am now as an introduction. So starting with my positionality as a white Afrikaans-speaking cisgendered woman, and this is really important. So we're going to be speaking about Afrikaner, but you can see Afrikaner in quotes and also white with a capital letter, so that we also just, you know, are sensitive around those those words, those terms, and what they mean, because a lot of people won't necessarily identify as an Afrikaner, and I don't really identify as an Afrikaner, but I'm very aware of the fact that I grew up in an Afrikaner family. And a lot of the communities that we're going to talk about today fall under the, I would say, like, classification of Afrikaner in terms of the way they live and ideals. So this identity still very much exists, but what people think of when they think of Afrikaner is also very different. So I, like I said, I grew up in a typical Afrikaner family, and what you would say in Afrikaans, like a trouwvrou, a mariable woman, I was kind of trained to be this, the ordentlike girl, sensible, good-mannered, quiet, good, yeah, very involved in the church. And I also say in my rationale that I went to the NGO church almost every Sunday of my young life, until I started resisting the narratives and the cultural training that I received there and from my community in high school, and started becoming aware of these outdated, politically incorrect views and values that were very present in my home and small town that they grew up in, Rawsonville. So it bothered me that the alternative, quote unquote, Afrikaner community was also just alternative to the conservative established culture. So I, when I started understanding that I'm not an Afrikaner, I also didn't like the idea that I'm an alternative Afrikaner, because it's still in relation to this. And I realized that I can't really break myself away from this Afrikaner identity, and that I will still be read in relation to the conservative group and therefore held to the same standards and scrutinized in the same way. And that most of the people in the Afrikaner group would look to me as a kind of quote-unquote failed Afrikaner, you know, that I am dragging the culture through the mud and not at all anymore a good girl, marriable woman. And
I have a question to interrupt you. But just
good, because otherwise I'll monologue.
Zoom in on, like, what do you think, because I've never heard the term, you know, failed Afrikaner, and it's actually very interesting. So what does a failed Afrikaner look like, if you had to, like, paint a picture of how you
understand it? Well, I can paint the picture of me, which is an outspoken, loud, controversial woman that has a lot of body hair, that swears, that is in a long-term relationship but not married and not looking to have a wedding, and also will probably, if I have children, when I have children, I'd like to have children, have them in a very uncontroversial way, which means to have the child in my kind of chosen family, which is already kind of strange. You know, the fact that I live in a community, which is not a digs, it's not a student house, it's an active family community where we grow together and have adult relationships and negotiations and discussions and grow together and play roles for each other also, you know, in the domestic space. And they're my chosen family. I choose to live this way, and I think I'll always live this way. Even if I don't live in the same house as the people I live with now, I'll try to get cottages close by each other so that we can still be in each other's lives. So I think this thing of having an opinion, speaking that opinion, talking about political conversations, you know, bringing up political issues and conversation with people in my life and in my community back home, and then also not dressing, speaking, or looking like a good girl.
Also living outside of the typical understanding of what the nuclear family looks like.
Exactly. And then also challenging the church, you know, like I used to be very religious, and I won't say that now I'm an atheist or agnostic. I think I am spiritual and I have a lot of respect for Christianity, but I don't go to church actively, and I don't agree with a lot of the things that happen or is preached in here church spaces. So I'm very aware of that, if that answers your question.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. You can continue. Yeah. You were laying out.
So what was interesting to me then is that in a lot of these contemporary political discussions around alternative Afrikanerdom and within what you would call quote-unquote alternative Afrikaner groups, a lot of the discussions were focused around the patriarchal structure and how men controlled and structured and policed these this cultural group to create back then, before apartheid and during apartheid, what was called the quote-unquote folk, which is the Afrikaans word for nation, but it had a bit of a different meaning. You know, it was, there was a lot in the word folk. However, when I started changing my life and incorporating more feminist values and changing the performance of my personality, it was the women in my community that I got the most policed by. And it was always done on behalf of men and in protection of men and what they would think and how to kind of keep them out of the life of a woman. But they were often instructed in the way of like, you need to shave under your arms because no man is going to find you attractive, or don't talk about your period in front of your father. Men shouldn't know about those women's things, and keep the peace, as no man appreciates a loud and a confronting woman. So this thing that I'm being policed by a woman for the sake of the comfort and the protection almost of the man was interesting. But I didn't get those comments from men in my community. And maybe it's different in other families, that maybe other people's fathers and uncles and grandfathers are more outspoken and more confronting about policing women. But in my experience, this was mainly done by women, even with regards to my sexuality. When I started being in a serious relationship, there was this whole thing in the church where one lady was jealous because that I was in a relationship with my current partner back in school already, and her daughter really liked Tabu. And then she started telling all the ladies in the church that Tabu and I are making out on the school fields and everything. And then after church in the school, this kind of what do you call it, the after school of church, what's that called again?
I feel like we've literally wondered about this on an aired episode before.
Anyway, where you get the training from the basically parents that decide that they now have knowledge of the Bible. These women came to me and they were like, we're so worried about you because you must remember that you are an example of a good woman that is in the church and you're representative of our community. So you shouldn't act in these ways, which they weren't even true. But still, the policing around my sexuality also came from women.
Yeah. And so it's also like the thing of like what you reminded me of was now like if you even as a little girl like sit on the table. I don't know why I wanted to sit on the table, but that thing of like you're not allowed to sit on the table, otherwise you won't get a man. And then that applies to anything that you want to do that you shouldn't do, consequence is always you won't get a man. And it's typically it's typically a woman saying that.
Yes, and we'll get to this like purity and sexuality, virginity thing later, because it's really interesting how a lot of the policing around women and how they should act in this communities, Afrikaner communities, links to sexuality and not being perceived as slutty or promiscuous. So then I was introduced by our wonderful friend Azil Kutsia to Christy van der Westhuizen's work around the concept of enclaves. And she basically says that Afrikaner communities post-apartheid basically just fled or migrated to these enclaved spaces where they now have these massive walls and electric fencing around it and have black bodies policing that space, like keeping it quote unquote secure, but essentially they've created these bubbles where they can still practice and maintain the culture in those bubbles without having other people come inside. So they're barring access to people not anyone can just go into those spaces. And in those spaces, they kind of have this private life that is sometimes often very politically problematic, but they're keeping themselves comfortable in their privileged spaces. And so this affirmed my suspicion that Afrikaner communities are safeguarding some problematic, violent things behind closed doors in their fenced-in communities. And Van der Westhuizen employs this notion of the enclaves to describe the subtle ways in which Afrikaner values are maintained in these spaces. So I started wondering, is it possible for me, because I have access into these spaces, to disrupt and highlight what is going on in those communities and kind of create some kind of activation so that people are not so comfortable in those spaces by playing out or playing with these performative relationships that are trained in these spaces. So this led to my initial research question of, can I use my white female Afrikaans body in live art activations to assist in the disruption of existing Afrikaner enclaves. And then another point of departure for this project was my understanding that that what is taking place in these Afrikaner enclaves is not separate or they're not separate from what is happening outside of these spaces. So the inclusivity, the privilege, the suppression that people experience from white people outside of the enclaves are directly linked to what is actually still maintained in the enclaves, right?
Yeah.
So, which makes it to me a very important and vital artistic project to explore, because I know these spaces, I'm allowed into these spaces. And as a white person, I've often in conversations just been like, you're just being thrown into the same group, that people will just assume by the way that I look that they can include me into a very problematic conversation. And this often happens in these spaces, that because of the way I look and the way I speak, I'm allowed access into that space.
Can you think of an example of that? Or like what?
Yo, I don't even want to repeat things that people say, but when people make racialized assumptions about other groups of people, and they'll say, "Ah, you know this and this about these kind of people," and I'm like, "I don't know that. Like that, I don't agree with that."
Yeah.
So in the past, I used to be really confronting in the activist phase of studying. I think in your early 20s, when you just enter university, you almost become violent in how you want to resist things. So what happened then was, I used to be the one that used to fight with everyone around the dinner table at Christmases. I would have massive arguments with my grandfather, and it'll always end up in an explosion. And I started being labeled as the one that's just difficult.
Yeah.
And so this is going to lead to something I'm going to speak about now. But I just wanted to say that also then through Christy van der Westhuizen's work in the specific article, which we will also unpack a bit later, that's called Still Pink and Pale, White Afrikaans Heterofemininity in Post-Apartheid South Africa, which she wrote in 2018. She says that white women are educators and trainers of the men and women that form the future Afrikaner communities, and that this is still very much so, that women are still the nurturers and the educators in the family, and that in that way, they serve this folk still, and in that way cannot be seen as not active in creating the Afrikaner ideal. They were very much active before, and I'll illustrate that soon now, but that they still are. And so let me just find my place here. So what I then realized is that Afrikaners are really good at hiding their problematic nature in plain sight. So they'll be quiet in spaces where they know that they shouldn't say something incorrect now, but then they'll go home and they'll just, word vomit all of their fucked up beliefs to each other and be like, yeah. And in my experience, they're also really well versed in shutting people out. Sweeping those that are too controversial under the carpet. So me being labeled as the difficult child made that people didn't want to include me in conversations anymore. The moment they started speaking, I could see they just have this like foggy wall coming up over their face and they're not listening to me. So now I'm starting to think like, okay, is there a way to actually navigate this space of access that I have into these closed spaces without being ostracized, but also not being assimilated? Because what I've noticed is that in the Afrikaans cultural field, the white Afrikaans cultural field, controversial content creators like, think for example, Jack Parow, they start as kind of anti-cultural artists that try to point out problematic Afrikaner characteristics through music and stage personality, like addressing the aging millennial middle-class white male by creating, this alternative Zef culture identity that swears a lot and mocks Afrikaner culture. And then they become this like controversial figure, and maybe they make it onto the scene and everything. And then he for example, was featured a lot in Huisgenoot and in Sari, and people are curious about him and everything. And then he gets invited to perform at Skospel, and eventually his music gets censored. There's not so much swearing. And over the years, I've noticed that he's been appropriated into the mainstream Afrikaner music industry and has become less confronting. So to me, it seems like the privilege and the access and the capital that Afrikaner communities offer often lead to these controversial figures then being assimilated into the pop scene and then becoming less controversial. So, and also, where are the women? The only one that I could really think of was like Karen Zoid, and maybe potentially Yolandi Visser, but then there's also a lot of problems around those figures, you know? So to me, I was asking my question, like, why has there not been a really vocal, visible anti-Afrikaner subculture group that has consistently demonstrated alternative ways of living post-apartheid? And it seems like if you do not sell out, then you are simply ignored. So this is also a problem, right? And I'm literally just going through my rationale, posing my problems now.
Yeah.
And then my project is further motivated by this frustration of the apolitical nature of South African popular culture, you know, like how media aimed at women like Sari magazine have kind of commodified feminist ideas, but neglect to acknowledge the really political complexities and disparities involved in representing diverse women identifying bodies. And this apolitical nature is something that Van der Westhuizen and also speaks about and directly links to the constructure of the Afrikaner folk and the Volksmoeder. And I don't know, maybe I should just go through my rationale and then come back to this point, because this is where I'll illustrate how the Volksmoeder has changed over time. Mm-hmm. And that this, you know, political, apolitical nature, I also see in a large portion of the people that I used to study with, women that I used to study with were at school at, that they're basically on the same road to the white picket fence life in the enclaves that their grandmothers and mothers walked, and there's not much that's different. Maybe now they're studying after school and they're getting their degree first, but it seems to me like everything is still within this like direction of need to get the man, you mean manfang, and then you can get the house and then you can get the children, and then what then? Do you die? Like, what's the purpose? So the absence of the Afrikaans-speaking women in political debates in South Africa is glaringly obvious to me. Like, although writers like De Toey and Van der Westhuizen and Kutsia that I mentioned before are making really important contributions in the theoretical debate around the Afrikaner problem, it seems to me that white Afrikaans women figures in the cultural sector, like content creators, playwrights, poets, etc., are either being swept under the rug, or they really have to struggle independently to create things that people can see, or they're avoiding to talk about these issues. And my question is, like, where is the contemporary Ingrid Jonker or the 28-year-old Ankie Kroch? Like, who is there at the moment that's creating art that's really in your face? And maybe I'm ignorant. Maybe there's just some figures that I don't know about. But why don't I know about them? You know, why aren't they in my face? Why am I not seeing them constantly? So taking into account the sweeping under the rug nature of the Afrikaner communities, in this first week that I was bombed into university, we had a research week and we did all these exercises to kind of refine our research questions in the big group of postgrad students with our lecturers and, you know, other people that work at the university. And my one question was, so how do I create content that sufficiently disrupts the enclave spaces without being ostracized or assimilated? And one of the lecturers in the group said this amazing thing to me. He said, "You play the fool." And this was like a epiphany moment. Like, it struck me like a cold bucket of water. I was like, wow. And then I started thinking about the fool, I started pondering humor and satire and thinking, okay, is the fool the same as the jester? Is it the one in the court of the kings that is actually the most clever and is making, analyzing everything that's happening and translating it for the nation in a very light and satirical way so that they can absorb what's happening? Or is it a foolish pop culture figures like Dove Dola or Leon Schuster or Casper de Vries or even Skalk Poseidon that make their money out of playing the fool? And then when I started thinking about these figures, I started realizing there's another thing around Afrikaners is plezierig, you know, this kind of saying that Afrikaners like having fun. We like laughing. We like telling stories. Think of Jan Spies and Tola van der Merwe. There's this culture of telling stories and laughing a lot.
Mm.
But there's also a very a long history of using slapstick humor to talk about political things. But to me, that is done in a way where, you know, if you think of Evita Besaidenhout, where at some point you can just laugh and not become self-reflective. It's not confronting enough. And Evita Besaidenhout played a very important role in the transition from apartheid to post-apartheid. But now she speaks still to me, to my grandparents' generation. Her work was done for my grandparents' generation with the Tani and kind of showing how the Tani and all her charity events and, you know, her ordentlikheid and her hospitality can be used to integrate the nation with, you know, diverse groups of people. But what is she saying now that's really making a difference? And how is she speaking to people my age or cultural content creators that are my age or maybe in their early 30s?
Yeah.
So
I just want to add one thing there. Like, when you said earlier, when you were talking about how good these white Afrikaner spaces are in terms of controlling who's in and who's out and sweeping certain things under the rug, and how you were always the one that's kind of being difficult and therefore just kind of an annoyance to have at a family meeting. Like, for me, that's also the phrase that came to me is also like, you are the one spoiling the fun, and linking that back to the Afrikaners is plezierig. So Afrikaners can be plezierig and everything is light and fun. And it's also that same, I think there's a saying, there's three things you don't talk about. You know, there's like, jy weet baie braai is al drie goed waar jy nie praat nie. And then it's like politics, finances, and what would be the other one? I can't remember.
Sex, I don't know.
Sex probably. But just this thing of like, there's certain rules for maintaining the fun and staying plezierige Afrikaners. And I think that's even those, the fools are the ones that can find the balance to keep things light enough to stay in.
Yes. And so yes, that's also making me think of how Afrikaners are also very often saying, let's not dwell on the past. But then when they start talking about the good old days, they become really nostalgic about problematic times.
Yeah.
So let's not dwell on the past in the sense like, let's not think about the role
apartheid
that all of us played exactly in apartheid and the privilege we have now. Let's not dwell on the bad things in the past. We're in the new South Africa now, but the good old days when we could have all run in the streets and like be safe, you know, those kind of ignorant comments. And I'm like, what are we nostalgic for? And what are we then, you know, we can't talk about the past in a critical way, but we can just, you know, dream about how it used to be without being honest about what it required for it to be that way. So yeah, it's an interesting thing, this Afrikaner is plezierig, and also how, especially as a woman, I feel in my life, I've often been like, this is not something that you should talk about. Like, this is not something that and it becomes even more annoying that it comes from a woman, you know, to bring up these kind of conversations, which is also interesting, and how I was often accused of being overly emotional and hysterical when I was arguing with people about these things.
Yeah.
So from the point of the fool, the biggest problem that I then faced in creating my first mini performance, which is not the Kulyander one, was a Simbamba one, was that it's very natural for me to become really intense and deep and creepy without intending to be that way. I think it's just my nature.
Yeah,
and
I think you even told me, you were like,
yeah,
I'm not naturally funny, I'm naturally eerie, which was very funny.
I think I am funny, but when I'm trying to be funny for some other reason, it becomes a little bit weird and twisted. And what kept following me around was this ghost of the Volksmutter, you know, that this ideal woman is really a ghost and functions in the shadows in the enclosed spaces. And I couldn't avoid the creepy nature of it. So then the first performance I created, we were tasked to incorporate our research question in some other way to look at performative ways that people are in public. So I specifically focused on, you know, white spaces, and I went to sit in a space and observed people and had to basically create a movement sequence out of that. And then I had to have a material and an object. So I had this doily yeekled crocheted blanket that my grandmother made, which was my object. And then the material was a piece of, a bag of cow dung or horse shit from Jana's garden. I was looking after Jana's house at that point, and I saw this bag of ground, and I found it really interesting. Also, yeah, thinking about ground and keeping things and the, you know, hoarding privilege and spaces.
I just want to say there that I was on holiday and Nicolene was looking after the house, and then she just messaged me like, I see there's a bag of horseshit in your garden shed. Can I please use it? I'm like, oh, well,
for art.
I'll put it back. I just want to carry it around for a while. For art purposes. I'm like,
yes. And then so to make the link between the fool, I went towards play and I went towards children's play. And the first thing that came to me was the song Simbaba that's sung as a lullaby and is really violent. It goes, Simbamba, mama sakanki, Simbamba, mama sakanki, draai sy nek, kom gooi hom in die sloot, trap op sy kop, dan is sy dood. And it's, you know, twist. It's like mom's child, Simbamba, mom's child, twist its neck, throw it in the ditch and step on its head, then it's dead. So it's like really, really horrifying. And as a child, it used to freak me out a lot, but it's this lullaby. And I started researching it, and it's really difficult to find, you know, accurate sources of where this comes from, because most of the sources basically are this like My Folk, Ons Folk kind of websites that have this nostalgic thing about Afrikaner culture. But I did find theories that Simbamba could be Simbamba, which could mean the swart gevaar, black danger, you know, and then that violence is directed towards black people, or it can be Simbamba, which is also the snake. You know, that's what I said now, right?
Yeah.
So that version, and then Simbamba just as a kind of lullaby thing, and then could be linked to the time in the Boer War when a lot of women, South African War, when a lot of women were in the concentration camps with their children and actually did kill their babies because they didn't want them to live in the concentration camps. So this flippant nature with violence in our children's songs and children's games became one of my focuses, that maybe from fool I go to play, and the link between the role that we play to each other as adults, how that is trained through children's games. And this then becomes a larger question that can apply to all cultures, like how do the games we play as children set us up to play roles as adults? And so this became then the focus, and I did this little performance and people really responded to the creepy nature of it. But then I wanted to push the game playing further, and from live art, then kind of transition towards play theory, where I'm starting to look more at play theory and how playing games can be an interesting performative act and become performances. So Jana, at this point, I need to ask you, am I going to go into telling them about the Kolyander performance, or should I go towards the history of the text of the Volksmutter before I go to the game? I'm not sure.
I was thinking, firstly, maybe if you can just quickly explain the difference between live art and performance art and play theory.
Oh, Lord.
That's a lot.
Oh, Lord. I don't even know.
Okay, so, like,
basically the reason I changed, because I thought when I signed up, I completely misunderstood the way that UCT functions. There's this center called the ICA, the Institute for Creative Arts, which I've done Infecting the City with before. And Jay Pather is the very famous choreographer that kind of is very fundamental in the starting of this. And this center kind of coined the term live art and started creating live art activations like in Infecting the City and the Live Art Festival and a lot of the things that they do around that. I thought I was applying to study under them because there was a scholarship for live art and public performance. So I applied with that in mind. Didn't get the scholarship, got accepted into UCT anyway. And then the day that I was phoned in bed, found out that the ICA is not a degree giving entity. They're just an institute that's part of the CTDPS, and that the scholarship students that are now in my class, they're studying with me, we're eight of us, they are encouraged to create live art activations. And live art has so many different meanings, but the idea is that a lot of it happens in the moment in collaboration with the audience, and it combines multimedia disciplined stuff, so light art, taste, sound, scent, all of this. And that the magic of live art is that it happens once live, and it's often not rehearsed a lot, you know, the brief or the concept of it is created and practiced around, and then the happening happens and it's over. And
yeah, so, there's a lot of unpredictability, and the audience almost becomes part of the performance.
Exactly. And so I still believe that I do live art, but I'm also a performance artist. And these terms, when it comes to live art, performance art started long ago in the history of performance art. It started as a medium to kind of subvert all the traditional modes of making art. So it characteristically goes against being defined almost, because it went from having and separate art piece from the artist to the artist's body becoming the art piece, and therefore being ephemeral in its nature and not almost undefiable and visceral and bodily in its nature. So play theory, I haven't started reading about this at all. I still need to. We can have another conversation about that. But play theory, as far as I understand, is just thinking about play as a performative act and how you can involve playing games in your performances to create experiences that can either be educational or transformative or disruptive or whatever. So I think I'm just veering away from calling it live art for now because I'm not part of the ICA officially. But how I classify what I do, I'm a multimedia artist that works in everything anyway. So it could be live art, it could be for performance art, it could be all of those things.
Okay, no, I think it's just good to know what you, to contextualize what type of performance this is. This isn't like a theater performance.
Not at all. And this is where it becomes clear when I talk about what the performances are created, because they are very live art in their nature. I don't know what's going to happen in them. I have an idea and I do practice, but every time I practice is different because I bring in different people, and the audience interactiveness is very key to it.
Okay. So with that in mind, I think tell us about your performance. This was the second performance you had to do after the Simbamba one, and when you started brainstorming for it, you were thinking about other eerie type of Afrikaans games and songs, and I think the one that you focused on was Kolyander, Kolyander. So tell us about how you came to that.
So
what's the game about and all of that?
Yes. So before I wanted to start to go into the domestic space, because in the long run I'm thinking about the Afrikaner enclave as a poppies, almost as a dollhouse. Like, I used to have this Wendy house in the back of my family home that was entirely my dollhouse. So it was basically just a smaller version of a house with a kitchen and a bed and everything. And then in those spaces, you play heis, heis, kombuis, kombuis, spiel, spiel, doctor, doctor, you know, all those kind of games. That if you say it twice, it becomes a game, but it's basically practicing how to be in the world. And often in those spaces, you've learned Yes, and what you've learned from your family in terms of roles and gender roles are practiced with your peers. So I'm thinking about that in the long run. But first, I wanted to go towards language and look at this violent nature of games. And Kolyander Kolyander is one that also stood out to me. The words go, Kolyander Kolyander, so dear die bos, my mama and papa cook lekker kos, my booty versik aan het drijven trost, die laaste in se kop wordt afgekap. So Coriander, coriander through the forest. My mom and dad cooks nice food. My brother chokes on grapes. The last one's head gets chopped off. And you, with one friend, make an arch with your arms, and then you run through around the ones, you make a figure of eight running through the arch around the two players that make the arch. And then this part of the last one's head gets chopped off. The two making the arch catch the person that's then in that moment running through, and then they're out.
Yeah.
And what was interesting is I thought that the game ended with, when you catch the one person, you take them aside. And before the game started, the two players that makes the arches, they decide on something that they like. Say, red cool drink or green cool drink. Okay, whatever it could be. Barbies or brat dolls or, you know, dresses or sneakers or whatever. You make something and then say, Jana is green cool drink and I'm red cool drink. The players of the game don't know this. So when you take the one aside that you've caught, you ask them, red cool drink or green cool drink, and whoever they choose, they have to go stand behind that player while the game continues until there is like this accumulated players behind both the main players making the arch, and then you play tug of war at the end. And obviously then the ones that fall over first or get pulled over first, they lose. But that I realized in my research was a custom part of the game that my cousins created. My grandmother passed away recently, and at the funeral I was like a week before the performance, and I had the opportunity to talk to the my family about this game, and they were like, oh no, that's something we added, because no one else knew that part of the game. And that was also interesting, so it changed my performance, because then I had to decide, am I going to add this custom ending or not? And then from this Imbamba performance, I wanted to, that was called the seed performance, and then the one, the Kolyander Kolyander, is called the minor performance. So it's really just still an introduction of our research questions through practice, and we need to illustrate where we are, but we also need to keep it open-ended so that it's, and obviously it is, because we're at the very beginning of our research, and so we have to have some kind of continuum. So I, in the Simbamba performance, with this crocheted blanket, created a little fort with chairs, you know, when you make those tents with the chairs, mm-hmm. and you throw a blanket over. So my performance took place outside, and then I crawled into the space and I sang a song and said a poem inside as well. So this was really interesting. There's like under the table, playing under the table while the adults are eating, or making something out of like a domestic space that's like a little enclave within the enclave, almost, right? Like the dollhouse. And I wanted to create this sense of me playing as a child. So I created this little cave that you can crawl into. And then in the Kolyander Kolyander performance, also decided to do this, but to build a box fort. So boxes with this cloth over. And then I made this doll called Sari. And it's basically a mannequin with a dress that's made out of doilies. This doily dress I used in performances before. And now it became Sari's dress. And I built it out to look even more Victorian. I put a tutu underneath it to like puff it out. I built a cuppy for her. And basically Sari's dress, the drape of Sari's dress, became the box fort under which I could crawl in. And she was this other player making the arch with me in the game. So then I showed what I'd done to my supervisor, and she was quite aware of Sari needing to have a more active role. So that's when I decided to, instead of having a big box fort that the audience can run through, to make Sari's dress the box fort. And for references for this, you can go check on my Instagram. There is some references of this, and I'll also post more of it, because I have the video of the actual performance that we did also. So then the biggest fear around this performance was, will the audience play with me? And what will happen if I speak to the audience in Afrikaans Another thing that I just want to say about my supervisor, she also pointed out to me that there needs to be a clearer link between me as a little girl and Sari, that represents the ghost of the Folkmoeder, this inanimate, almost monument-like figure standing outside of my dollhouse. I'm crawling in under her dress to hide away. It's my little fort, my little safe space. But there needs to be a clearer link. So I ended up making a dress out of duct tape that looks very similar to Sari's dress. So I kind of started looking like this futuresque Volksmutter character, like, almost. Yeah. But the link is still clear. So this juxtaposition of materials to create a relationship and to kind of highlight a critical lens. I'm looking at it in a different way, but I'm aware of the ideological link and the performative link through the way that I was trained as a child to kind of be this ideal woman. And so then I was really worried about what the audience will play with me or not, whether they'll understand Afrikaans or not. And so I had to figure this out with performative ways, failed and succeeded in a couple of ways. But the main thing was that when they came in, I introduced the game as a child. And Your Honor requested that I do this before we started recording as a child. But basically, when they came into the performance, I was underneath Sari's dress in this box fort. And I was like, hello, 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 come in, look at my eyes. This is Sari. Sari, oma, Maria, for Sari for my gegee. And Sari is just like, she's a cooler, ouer tannie, wat she's for my met leer, who is just a goeie dogtertjie te wees. En Sari, net ek kan vir Sari verstaan. En Sari, wat sê jy? Okay, Sari sê, ek moet vir julle sê dat so dogtertjie speel nooit donker kamertjie nie. Dis nie 'n game wat so dogtertjie speel nie. En wat? Snacks. Sari sê ons moet snacks. Ek het vergeet van die snacks. Julle, ek het klapperys gemaak en elkeen van julle kan net een lokkie kry. Okay, moenie soos meer vat nie, want dan is daar nie genoeg vir almal nie. En ons gaan 'n game speel. Maar kom kyk eers, hierdie is my box fort en net ek mag daarin klim. Dis my space. Okay? En dan ons gaan 'n game speel, Koriander en okay, ek gaan nou vir julle leer hoe die game gaan. So I spoke like that. I played like that. So very animate, very slow, like a child, and a lot of like illustration with my body. And then I also gave them instruments to play with. And I said that while we're playing the game, some of those, because my lecturer was like, what's going to happen if 50 people rock up and you can only play the game with 8 people? You know, you need to think about these things. So I had instruments that I made out of like jars with popcorn kernels in and things like that, like buttons in a tube and things you can beat with, and then an accordion. And what was really interesting, I was the first person to perform, and some of the feedback that I got was that playing a game at the beginning of a day of performances with a panel walking around, you know, judging and then giving feedback the next week, it really put people into their bodies to play, and people got really into playing this game. They played so loudly that they didn't hear the subtle changes in the song that I made, because I rewrote Koliander Koliander to say something different every time in the next verse, because you sing it every time until all the players are caught, right? And then they couldn't hear that. So there were some interesting things that I discovered around how to play and as an act of performance, how to make it clearer and that I can incorporate into my next performances. But yeah, that was basically it. And then at the end of the game, the person that won, how I ended it was to then, as a little girl, realize that because I was the one chopping off the heads, I couldn't win. And then I threw a tantrum and I chased everyone out and I crawled under this, underneath the dress into the box fort, and I sat there and I spoke to Sari and I was like, Sari, hulle is soke stout maatjies en nou kon ek nie die game gewen het nie en dis nie lekker nie want ek het die hele tyd nog staan en dis nie fair nie, like this. So, and basically it was like, and they were left just seeing Sari. She was kind of standing there and I was underneath, like talking, and then I would speak on behalf of her, like, Sari sê julle moet huis toe gaan. Like, Sari says you must go home now, you know, like this. So that was the first performance. Learned a lot out of it, especially with some of the feedback that I got, critical feedback. I got amazing feedback. I was really scared to do this, and I think it was a big movement for me to actually do this performance, to claim the fact that I am a performance artist and I don't need a degree to perform, which is I realized subconsciously a reason that I started doing this, because I had insecurity about being a performance artist, but that I am a performance artist and that I must just perform. That's what makes me a performance artist. So I did it and I got really great feedback. And some of the critical feedback I got was around the language, that my lecturer said something really interesting, that I don't have to not speak in Afrikaans, but I have to take a moment to teach the audience the significance of the words. And I need to make the language thing clearer. So to, if I teach them the song and they can sing it with me, and then halfway through I start changing the words while we are playing, they'll notice that there's change, and that'll create that, like, even if they don't know what the change means, they know that I've changed it. So to start thinking about, if I'm creating performances, because the idea for me is to do these games, to play these games in Afrikaner communities, I still need to think about accessibility, because I don't want to exclude people while I'm on this journey in my master's, even though I have the idea to one day, you know, activate Afrikaner spaces with it. Yeah. So that was the performance. Any questions? Yana? Any things to say?
I think it's so fascinating. Like, I just, like, hearing you describe the performance, and well, firstly, I'm just so entertained by your, like, depiction of the child who's playing these games, because it's so familiar. I could really relate to both being that child, like being the one that takes charge, and like the almost like children's power dynamics that comes out in that, and also how it feels when another friend is being quote unquote bossy in playing these games, and how annoying it can be to be around a person like that, but everyone secretly wants to take charge. And it also just brought up so many memories of the types of games we played as children, without questioning what do these words mean, and what are we actually saying, and what are we actually doing. So a weird conditioning of almost going through life uncritically, reiterating some kind of script that you have been told. So I really enjoyed the way in which you related this analysis that you gave earlier about Afrikaner enclaves, the Volksmoeder, the training we have, how basically how we are conditioned to be contemporary Afrikaners, and how they are roots in our childhood. So I thought the way you executed that was very striking. And this was just one example. Like, obviously, you could think of different games and have similar messaging in it. So I think almost to the one thing I wanted to ask you was if you wanted to read how you changed the lyrics, because the way you changed the language really reflected the way in which the performance was also an act of subversion. Maybe you can even read it at the end of the episode. It doesn't have to be now.
I can do it now, but I don't have the words with me. That book is in a different room. But I had to memorize it, so I think I can remember it. So from Koljander, Koljander, Shudiri, Bos, my mama and papa quick lekker kos, my booty verstik aan a drijven troos, die laas die ense kop voort af a kap. It went to Koljander, Koljander, Shudiri, die box, my mama quick altijd kos, my booty verstik aan a man se troos, die laagste ense kop voort af a kap. And then it went Koljander, Koljander, Shudiri, die doos, my papa werk homself foos, my booty first drink on the driver throat. So it's drowning in the in wine, essentially, was the analysis that I was trying to make there. The maagste eense kop word af a kap. So the virgin, the most virginities one's head gets chopped off. And then it went Koljander, Koljander, Shudiri, die huis, Koljander, Koljander, Shudiri, the house, through the house, Shudiri, die huis, my mama and papa slaan lekker vuis, my mother and father is hitting each other with the fists. My brother is becoming gray faster. My booty word vinnig en vinniger grys. Die stadigste een, so the slowest one's head gets chopped off. And then it went again, Koljander, Koljander, so deur die bos. My mama and papa span die os. So they're what do you say, span die os? They're
almost like preparing the carriage.
They're preparing the ox wagon. They're preparing the ox wagon. And my brother is hunting jackals. So I jag jackals of course. The eerste een se kop word afgekap. So that was an analysis of like, you know, the voortrekker with the os, and you know, when the first voortrekkers went into the country, the fighting against the first people that were here in South Africa, actually, you know, the original people from South Africa. And then I can't remember the rest, but you see how I changed it from like from bos, from forest to box, to duis, which is also box, but it means the same as vagina. From like my mother and father cooking food to my mother cooking, always cooking food, my father working himself to death, my brother drinking too much. You know, so I tried to play with,
and also the brother being gay.
The brother being gay, the brother getting gray, you know, like also a thing of working and, you know, losing a sense of play as an adult. So I kind of changed it like that. But that was a part that got lost in the game because people got so into it. Like the people that participated in the game were screaming and fighting each other to not get their heads chopped off. And they were really interactive and really acted like children, which is amazing. But because of their screams and their loudness and their running and their playing, they missed a lot of those words changing. And it's also in Afrikaans. So my challenge is to think if I'm going to play more with the performative aspect of being a child, as in the instruction, and potentially going more to the domestic space and the dollhouse, which I think I will do, but how I will translate this language change, subtle language changes, and if I will do that again. And I was also thinking about playing with, in the future, with playing cards, so that Kulyanda is written out on playing cards and that they can then scramble it. And one person is scrambling the words and saying to the people that are going to sing the words how to sing it, you know, so that three people are kind of making up out of the words that I give them different sentences and therefore get involved in the subtleties of language changes. But that's still something that I'm thinking about.
But what does the, if you had to now analyze this performance, not in terms of your experience of performing it, but just the meaning that it had for you before interacting with other people, what does the subtle changing of the words mean to you, the subtle changing of language?
So I wanted to talk about what happens in the Afrikaner enclaves. So this idea of the role of the mother, the role of the father, the role of the brother, but there's something around how men in Afrikaner spaces are not really being charged to also think critically about things. And they're also not really being pressured to play a specific role except for being the provider of the family, where women are policed quite a lot. Men's, we've spoken about this in the wedding performance episodes as well, how men's sexuality are not policed as much. I'm not talking about sexuality in terms of fluidity. That, of course, is policed or shamed, but more that men are allowed to explore their heterosexual, very important sexuality from a much earlier stage without so much shame as women. And the act of drinking a lot when men become older, that was a link to Azil Kutsi's episode with us around the, I think it's the Aikikuruk poem where she says that the men drink desperately at the bars, the built-in bars. Mm. And this is really something that I've noticed a lot in the Afrikaner community, that there's actually a lot of alcoholism that's not being called alcoholism, and that kind of keeps people passive. But also the subtle changes in language is about the subtleties of what is said in these communities, how something can be said in a very indirect way that has massive consequences and weight, how people just very flippantly can talk about very violent things and not really question each other, how through language I'm often thrown into the same group as Afrikaner people, and they just assumed that I should listen to these things because of the way that I look and speak and where I come from. And also to point out the violence of the original song, you know, so that the original song is just sung very like without scrutiny, But if you change the words just slightly, the nature of the song becomes a little bit clearer, you know, and almost that if I then add other violent and upsetting and strange things about Afrikaner culture to the song, and it's still sung in this like easy la 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 way, does it change the nature of the game? Does it add to the nature of the game? Does it highlight how problematic the game is? Or will it just also be ignored because it's just the game. It's just play.
Yeah. And it's so easy to play along. I think that's what it's actually funny that from your performance, even though it wasn't, you know, there was a language barrier for most of the participants who didn't understand Afrikaans or speak Afrikaans, but something about the fact that you said they couldn't hear the change in lyrics because they were having too much fun playing along. I think that is something that probably resonates, even if you did it with a crowd of lots of people who could understand, the outcome might be the same.
Yes.
Because that's also part of the point you were trying to make about the enclave and Afrikaner culture, that the easy thing to do is to just play along.
To just play along, exactly. Even as adults, you know, if I get children, will I teach them Kolyadipya? I know I won't, but you know, I wonder if people think about this, and then at the moment when they do teach their children, do they ever think about the violent nature of the game? Because the way that I think I did ask, I can't remember as a child, but I imagine I was a very curious child, and my dad always says I came out of the womb asking why, like hukom was my first word, and I just wanted to know why. And I'm sure I asked, like, why these words? And I am sure the answer was, it's just a game. Don't take it so seriously, you know? And this is the link that I'm trying to make with the adult performance of the roles that we play as well. And also around the Volksmoeder, because the looming figure of Sari is very important, because she, I think, in different forms will persist being in my games, because it is this almost playmate that you're introduced to as a very young girl, where you are taught to perform your personality almost already as a grown-up woman. You have to be quiet, reserved, ordentlik, like sensible. No, you have to think...
Volwassen, mature.
Yeah, mature. You have to think of the... You have to think of the family. You are encouraged to naturally have nurturing qualities. You know, you have to think of babying people, of raising, of nurturing, of feeding. You have to not be, you know, sexual, all of these things. So there's an innocence in the performance of sexuality in Afrikaner, which is interesting to me, when it comes to women. But then there's also this expectation that you need to be mature from such a young age, for women specifically. And yeah. I think this is a good point to come to Christy van der Westhuizen and PhD, and just illustrate how this role of the Volksmoeder changed through the ages, because this I found endlessly fascinating. Yeah.
Please share. Because I also think it's so interesting how you made the Volksmoeder Sari became almost like your imaginary friend in this performance. And in a way, I think a good analysis of how the Volksmoeder still lingers and haunts us today. Yeah. In a way, you could say the claim that you are making is all women who conform to this like white Afrikaner femininity is still playing the Volksmoeder, whether you recognize it or not. So it would be interesting to see how the Volksmoeder has then shifted over time to this point where you are not cognizant of the figure of the Volksmoeder or the shadow of the Volksmoeder.
Yeah. So before the South African War, the pioneering woman or the Boer woman or the voortrekker woman was a little bit different. And in the sense that they weren't so politically involved. So now I'm talking directly out of Christy van der Westhuizen's PhD, from which she then wrote the book Sitting Pretty. So everything I'm saying now comes out of her research. It's in Appendix A at the end, where it's literally a short history of the Volksmoeder. And so she says that the pioneering or the voortrekker woman was different in the sense that she wasn't politically so involved in helping create this and maintain the folk, this nation. But then the South African war came and women became the people that took over the household, and they became the head of the house, the farmers, the activists for the independence from the British, kind of holding the home ground while the women, the men went away to fight. And so after the South African war, the idea of the Volksmother was actually like solidified, and also in this kind of like tough, self-sufficient survivors of the harsh environment, where they continue to preserve racial purity in the face of what she says here, black barbarism, and instigators who like persuaded the men to continue to fight against the British. As religious, freedom-loving, honorable, selfless, and incorruptible. So what was added to this original qualities of the pioneering Afrikaner woman was the political charge that they had. And what was interesting is that through the war, the masculinity was recalibrated so that women became more manly. Than the men, actually, in the sense that they were running a lot. They were the heads of the house. They were running a lot. They were on the farms. They were fighting. They were encouraging the men, like all of this. And so while the women still continued to like encourage men to fight and fight again for this independence, the men were ready to stop the war. And then what happened is they changed their roles from heroines to vulnerable victims in need of protection, while promising the men that they will get this like paternal authority. So, yes, paternalist authority. I'm just checking that I read that word correctly. So it's interesting that this changed, that from these activists, head of the houses, Buddha women on the farm, go fight men, that didn't work anymore. So what did they do? They actively started performing the victims. They actively started performing that we need to be saved. We need to be saved by the men. We need your help. And so the patriarchal authority replaced the fraternity, and thousands of Joans of Arc became mothers of the nations. So this is really where the Volksmoeder then started becoming. So this invisibly visible as the symbolic fantasy to address the problem of the real actual woman posed to the nation, woman is yoked into the chain of equivalence with motherhood, nurturing, caregiving, and then displacing the actual, you know, varieties of femininity that they can be. This became the core things, that they're the mothers, they're the nurturers of the nation, but they need to be protected. They're so fragile. And the Victorian domestic ideology started becoming real important in creating this ideal woman, that they were, you know, their highest calling was to be in the home, and where they physically and morally reproduced the nation. Okay, how fascinating is this? So then, let me just see. The RCFFIA was still, so the reason that Christie van der Best says and is illustrating this is to illustrate that the women in the Afrikaner nations were very involved in creating the folk that then led to the folk of apartheid, and that whole ideology of keeping the nation pure and all of that, that they weren't passive. Even though they were delegated to the domestic realm, they were the ones reproducing the nation. And, you know, like I said earlier, they were the educators and the trainers of the women and the men in the household that would then become the folk. Yeah. So another thing and the way that they were active in later years was the RCFFIA, the Afrikaans Christian Women's Association, were very active in, you know, the production of the nationalist discourse through charity events, like in bringing up the poor whites. So the whole poor white project and lifting up the poor whites, they were really involved in that. And so in that sense, the racialized welfare activities of creating a division so that more white Afrikaans people could become middle class, so that the middle classness of the white folk could be established. And then in the, let me just see the dates here. So the RCFFIA contested against the suffragettes in 1907 and expressed the opposition for women to get a vote. And the NG Church was also like, this is not the place for women to to now get a vote in the 1920s. And they said that the NG Kerk in the 1920s said that for the women to get a vote, and by expanding this, they expanded the Volksmoeder ideology and discourse by saying that it's becoming threatening to the well-being of the family and the state for women to be politically involved. But then when women were granted, yeah, so then when women were granted the vote in 1930, it was a political act from Herzog's side to flesh out the vote of white people. So in order to have more people to vote, exactly. So this is to shore up the vote, which women's political rights then hinged again on the utility of the folk and the race. So now they get political rights, but still in service of the nation, right? And therefore, women's citizenship was mediated through the maternal function of the folk, as her citizenship was mediated through the matrimonial relationship with a man, right? So that whole thing of like the nuclear family and the role in there and all of that. So then the NVPs got absorbed into the women's party after getting the vote was absorbed back into the national party, and immediately women were sent back to the domestic realm. I just want to find this part because it was so let me just see. Here it is. The Volksmoeder discourse that permitted political engagement and had been readapted to redirect white Afrikaans-speaking women away from politics and the labor market to the domestic sphere after the NVPs merging with the male party. So that was also interesting how they were then sent back to the home and how they were their task to raise the men that will become the leaders of the nation. So this thing of the Volksmoeder from the strong women that had a political influence just after the war and during the war, then towards, being the victim, then and softer, and where the damsel Victorian ideology, the damsel in distress, where the Victorian ideology of femininity comes in and all of that, and how they dress and how they act and how they need to direct themselves towards charity and hospitality and, you know, doing events and things like that. And towards women starting to fight for the vote and then being like, okay, you can vote, but you vote for the nation. And then they gave them the vote and they were like, okay, now back to the domestic realm. Almost all political figures, female political figures, disappeared from the public sphere in that time. They went back to the domestic realm. And then now you can ask us, so during apartheid, there was obviously also that role of, you know, being involved in the upkeep of the men's political activations by maintaining the household, doing the domestic labor, you know, doing charity events. The RCFFF was also very involved in that. And there becomes really interesting to me to think about all the things my grandmother did around the RCFFF had a lot of like competitions and things. And the church committees around how to bake the perfect cake or cook sisters or knit the perfect sweater or make the perfect doily
arrangements.
Exactly. And how that busyness in training women to be a certain way is a busyness that kind of continues from the Boer War in terms of women always doing things, these women always doing things, but then it became these like tedious tasks on how to, you know, be the perfect domestic woman. And to train women to kind of all be the same in way and keep each other busy so that they're not politically involved. During apartheid, of course, women weren't politically involved and were also like not encouraged to be politically involved, but were very active in maintaining the nation. So this is what she's saying. And then Christy van der Wes says in another article called That Still Pink and Pale article, which I really love the title of. She kind of exposes the myths that still exist in Afrikaner spaces around womanhood. The myth one is that women, so she does interviews with modern South African women to kind of see what are the characteristics of the Volksmoeder still exist in South Africa and how do people think about the Volksmoeder now. And this was fascinating to me because like three of the myths that I'm going to talk now, she pointed out was that women are the neck of the family and the men is the head. So this is actually came out of the interviews. There's these interviews you can read between the women, and it's so fascinating how they explain this, that we actually know that women turn the head. They're the one that turn the head, even though the man is the head of the house. So this kind of unspoken thing that women kind of run that space anyway.
A little bit like need that to... achter elke man, behind every man, there's a powerful
exactly woman,
but she's in the sidelines and working behind the scenes.
Exactly. She's in the shadow. She's in the back, the unspoken rule of women running that space. And then women as natural nurturers through choice. So the natural nurturers thing that changed post-apartheid, Christiane Wesseling writes about, is this addition of choice, that a lot of women will say, well, I choose to serve my husband, allow him to be the head, acquiesce to all the tasks and things that's expected of me, raise children, bear children, because it's my choice, without thinking about how that choice has been trained into them, right?
Yeah.
And then the third one is women as instinctual family adhesive, that they're the ones that need to keep the family together and therefore can't fall apart or say controversial things or ask difficult questions. They should maintain the peace and keep the family together. And what was interesting from this article was that she said that the word Volksmoeder has been disjointed from these characteristics, that even though the characteristics that I read earlier about the Volksmoeder is still very, think about South African tannies, Afrikaner tannies, you know, they really still do embody this way of being, this performance of womanhood. But that when you ask those kind of people now about the Volksmoeder, they'll speak about Evita Vasadenote or other kind of figures that's not them. So what she says is really dangerous is that the characteristics of the Volksmoeder is still being trained and performed in these spaces, but it's been dislodged from this long history of where it comes from and all the problematic phases it went through. Mm. And this is why I want to bring the ghost of the Volksmoeder in, because I really feel her in that, you know, when my mom and my grandmother used to speak about, you know, good girls should, they were talking about this ideal. They were keeping me to this ideal. And also Batsali means to say, what would the people say? It often felt to me like there was this looming figure watching me, judging how I'm sitting, how I'm talking, how I'm dressing, how I'm grooming my body. And to me, that's the Volksmoeder still. You know?
Yeah, I think it's I like the word that you used, you are resurrecting the Volksmoeder, like the mummy or something, where it's coming out, it's been there all the time. And it's believed to be dormant, but it's not. And the fact that you then trace it back to say that even in contemporary senses, when you think you are just playing an innocent game as children, the kind of Volksmoeder training has already begun. So yeah, I want to thank you for sharing this project, even if it's in its like early forms, because I think there's already so much content, so much to say about it, and I'm so excited to see how it develops and what other games you come up with and how it is received by the audience, and if you do get ostracized or not, if you will manage to like find that balance of subverting it from the inside out.
And I think that we've continued talking about it, because it does feel a little bit, I mean, from Christiane Wesseling's PhD, I've probably read about 50 pages only, you know, not even that much. So I am really, really in the beginning of this. I probably did say it in the beginning, I can't remember, but if I didn't, disclaimer that I might be completely ignorant in some of the things that I say, and that I say them wrong because I'm at the beginning of my research. I don't know. So we'll continue to talk about this, and I'll update you guys as I update Jana on how the project continues and grows.
But I think a lot of the intuitions are the reason why you make those claims is also because they resonate. And like I know from past experience also, is that if something like this resonates with us, there's a big chance that a lot of other people also remember this and will be like, oh yeah, I've been trained to be a Volksmoeder.
So this actually makes me think now to somehow use Erit as a way to help me with my study, because this was a question that I had to my lecturers, that what if a research inquiry starts with an intuition and then you start chatting to other people and they affirm this intuition and what they've experienced, how do you use that data? And they said that I have to collect these experiences from people that I talk to. And I've done this with Jana and some of my other friends. But if any of you that listen to this podcast experienced similar things, or it made you think of other games, or it makes you the link between the games you played as a child and who you became as an adult, or how it taught you to be an adult, specifically linked to Afrikaanerdom and womanhood, please send me an email and tell me your story. You can also send me a voice note and I can transcribe it. But if you don't have Instagram and you can't find me on Instagram, you can please email me at burger, like a hamburger, nicoline3@gmail.com. I would really appreciate to hear your experiences, and it could also add to the data that I use in the study. I'd love that.
Yeah, great. I'm glad you took that opportunity, Nicoline, because in a way, Erit is also reaching some kind of enclave, Africa, especially an enclave. So, well, okay. Good to be back, and there will be more to come.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for listening. As always, stay stimulated.